What's up, sports fans? It is a new year, 2020, and we'd like to welcome you back to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm back. I'm King Kaz, and joining me, as always, the one, the great JVZ.
Hot take. Hot Jeopardy's take. A sport. I'm saying it right now. And because I had just as much fun watching Jeopardy earlier this week as I did watching a lot of other sports, and it's competitive, and it's high pressure, and it is just as competitive as esports, which we cover heavily and love, and we also cover Scrabble and the spelling bee.
Do we cover Scrabble?
I think we had a Scrabble story once. So yeah, I mean, hey, competitive Tetris, yeah, that's totally.
Hold on,
that's esports. So. Yeah, I mean, we take a very broad definition of sports here, and throwing. I don't even think Jeopardy is that. DJM says no curling, but I like curling. But yeah, Jeopardy. They had the greatest of all time tournament, and I guess no spoilers if you want to check it out. I think you can replay it on Hulu, but. But yeah, they took three of the best Jeopardy players of all time and put them up against each other, and like multiple matches, like two matches per day, and then each somebody had to win 3 days in order to win the whole tournament. So it's fun, and these guys are impressive both in how much they know, how quick they are on the buzzer, and how much they choose to risk whenever they have a chance to risk. It's just like, it's a strategy minefield. It's fun.
Yeah, and there's a bit of gambling, right?
Like, yes. Yes. And I think this tournament started because James Hofhauer, I'm not going to say who won just because I just to give people a chance to go watch this
2 weeks.
And without spoilers, yeah, right. 2 weeks I guess is the time period, but James Hofhauer, who like recently went on a run, kind of I think he won like 50 games in a row or 50 mm-hmm. nights in a row, and his strategy basically made everybody rethink the way Jeopardy used to be played, because it used to be that you went down a column. Or you started at the top with like the easiest questions, and then you built momentum as you went down. And Hofhauer basically decided he's going to go across, and he's going to start from the bottom at the largest dollar values, and then so that by the time he got to the daily doubles, he would actually risk everything, and he had a lot to risk, and he would get those right, and then he would build up these massive leads that nobody could catch up with. The other two that he were competing against is Ken Jennings, who is mm-hmm. famously went on like a 72 game winning streak back in, I want to say like 10 years ago or so. And
God, was it that long ago?
Yeah, it's making me feel kind of old. And then Brad Rutter, who like maybe 10 years before that, this was back when they, after 5 days, if you won 5 days straight, that was it, and you were done. And so, but despite all that, he won like all the special tournament of champions and stuff. So he's won more money than anybody else.
Okay.
In Jeopardy, Ken Jennings is like each of these guys has like notable records, and so like they excel. They're all good enough at this that they basically just make money playing Jeopardy, and just in trivia in general, in the whole trivia industry, and just being around it and just being famous off of their Jeopardy performance, because they're each notable in three different ways, it's kind of cool to see like how well they can adapt to each other's strengths, and just. In general, like I think the first game, I think there are only like three questions missed the entire time. Like it's just impressive just how much knowledge these people are able to retain, period. So check that out.
Oh yeah. All right, so we're going to get into the roundup. We're going to start with, I guess something a bit somber. Well-known NBA frontman David Stern has passed away a few days ago.
Frontman, Kaz?
The former NBA commissioner. I think that's what Kaz is trying to say. But
I don't know. I like frontman.
The predecessor to Adam Silver today, David Stern, who I think when he took over the league, the NBA finals were on tape delay. That's how people describe that. That's how unimportant the NBA was at the time. And he's turned it into, you know, the second biggest sport in the United States, one of the biggest sports in the world, and still expanding. There's massive amounts of money. There's teams worth over $1 billion. It wasn't without controversy, but for me personally, the Sacramento Kings would not exist as the Sacramento Kings today without David Stern. He helped bring the team to Sacramento in the first place, and during the two periods where there were relocation issues and trying to move the team to Anaheim first and then moving the team to Seattle after that, he kind of stayed firmly in the side of Sacramento and helped keep the team in town. There's some nights where I kind of wish they left, but they're, overall, like I'm glad to at least still be able to watch basketball and still be able to call that team my own. And so I actually, one of the streets that like walk on near the arena, it's called David J. Stern Walk. So it's named after him. And just the new arena itself, it kind of has his fingerprints on it, because he's what helped, what helped set that up. I'm sure the cities that did have their teams taken away, they don't think of him too kindly, like Seattle. He's definitely left his mark on the league, and the league definitely grew a lot during his tenure. Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to other stories. Trae Young, second-year player in Atlanta for the Hawks, has canceled a shit ton of debt for some of the citizens of Atlanta. Over $1 million in medical debt that he kind of purchased debt. I guess some of this debt kind of gets packaged and sold at a discount to debt collectors, and so he bought some of it at a discount and then forgave it. And he says this is something that has affected him personally. So it's nice to see players giving back, especially young players, because that's kind of something that players don't tend to do until later in their careers when they feel a little bit more secure.
Yeah. That, or like you said, this is something that is kind of a personal effect to him. So this is probably something like dealing with debt collectors, which is something at this point a lot of people in his age range have to deal with, unfortunately. Yeah. And especially medical debt, like especially here in America, where our health system is not the best. And people sometimes are scared to go to hospitals because of how much things cost just to be seen or have something looked at and stuff like that. So this is just something that I don't know. This is kind of one of those things that I think really kind of shows somebody's character. It's so specific, right? Like to just do what he did. Because people make careers out of buying people's debts and then harassing them for it. Yeah.
Sorry to jump in, but to put it in perspective, this is an average of $1,800 per person for 570 people. So that, like, there are 570 people now that are not getting harassed on the phone because Trae Young pitched in and helped out. So that's, you know, even if you don't want to look at the dollar value, just the time and the sheer annoyance factor of these people don't have to deal with now. Like, he's saved a lot of people a lot of stress. So,
yeah,
good for him.
And it's a good little article. It's a local article from Atlanta. And I think it's worth giving a read. I mean, and hey, at the end of the day, it definitely helps, you know, show kind of his character as a person coming into that city and doing something really big for them like that, you know. Moving on, we're going to stay with the NBA, but we're going to move into scandal. We got some scandalous news. Stephen Curry was caught talking to a Greek god.
Steph Curry and Giannis Antetokounmpo were, I mean, Curry's tampering. Injured. Yeah, there's another tampering scandal.
Tampering!
Steph was caught on the sideline saying, "Let's do this. Come on." And everybody interpreted that to be, "Oh, these guys are trying to team up with each other in basketball." So, but no.
Giannis is coming up on free agency at the end of this year. So in 2021, the Greek god will be a free agent, and he will be on the market. And obviously,
I like how you've upgraded him from Greek freak to Greek god.
Yeah, no,
I feel like he's earned that though. Like, yeah, he was the MVP last year. So
I think hold on, time out from the story. I think this kid is amazing. I think his basketball IQ is really, really good. I think he has just an amazing understanding of the game. I think for his size, he doesn't suffer the problem that some guys do, where he's either kind of too big, like kind of physically, or he's too small, kind of muscularly. I think he just has a really good basketball physique, and I think he plays the game at a level that will, at some point, if he can continue to play that way, change the way the game is played.
JVZ. JVZ, how was you're the Zach Lowe of this podcast? How was Kaz's analysis of Giannis Antetokounmpo?
I think that's pretty spot on. Like, I could say he's got like a Kevin Durant. He's got like Kevin Durant measurements as far as like length, but he's got LeBron level musculature. Which makes him a matchup nightmare for anybody who's trying to guard him. And on top of that, he's, you know, like Kat said, like he's a smart player. And on top of that, he is developing like new skills all the time. This year, he added a 3-point shot when before he didn't need it, but now he's got it. And it's,
so, Kaz, do you think that James Dolan will for the New York Knicks as we make that transition? I really like this upcoming Knicks story. I really like it.
Let's circle back around and finish this one first, because God, no. Of course, the sports media jumps out and decides that this is collusion, this is tampering. Steph Curry is trying to build the team for the future. But Steph was reached out to by some reporters and things like that, and says, and this is from the word of Curry himself, that it was nothing more than him asking Giannis to play PUBG with him. If you're not familiar with what PUBG is, Players Unknown Battlegrounds. It is a battle royal game, and he said he was giving him his gamer tag and saying, "Yo, let's team up, let's play some games, and let's have some fun." I mean,
do you believe him?
There is an easy way to check. You know what I mean? Like, if they're if he's using gamertag, you can just check and see if he actually even plays that game. But I mean, I don't know. I'll take a man at his face value. Fucking LeBron buys people dinners and takes them out on lavish dates, and nobody really jumps teeth at that. But you know what I mean? Steph Curry has somebody to play a game with him, and we're going to doubt the man.
Guys, we're all vamping and trying to turn this into a bit, but no. The story completely falls apart with one obvious glaring detail.
Okay.
Nobody's playing PUBG.
Thank you, JVZ. Thank you for pointing that out. Ding dong, but JVZ wins.
Of all the battle royals that now currently exist, if I had to play one, it'd be PUBG.
I mean, sure. Me too, because I have it. But it's the game that started all of that. And then Fortnite kind of took it over and completely ran with it. But it's,
for me, I like the style of PUBG over Fortnite, right? Fortnite is very cartoony.
Right.
It's very kind of Twitch shootery if you want to get into the mechanics of the game. And Steph Curry, you know, a precision shooter kind of guy, I think in his games, he also likes precision shooting. So maybe that's why he prefers PUBG. I'm just saying.
But all this basically goes to highlight, like, mm-hmm. at this point, like, with all these tampering rules in place, like, you have, there's, like, no way to enforce this shit. <That's>, like, it's two guys talking to each other, but you don't know for sure whether they kept it strictly personal, or maybe they dove into the business side of it a little bit, and there's, mm-hmm. like, there's no way to tell, there's no way to police it. You can't police LeBron and his dinners, like, you can't stop these guys from being friends with each other, and so, like, minor shit like this. This is like the fifth story of minor shit like this just getting, like, amplified, and who knows how much.
I think you need a third party lawyer. Anytime LeBron invites somebody on a date, there should be a third party lawyer just sitting there eating entrees
and recording the dinner. Like, at this point, that's what they're gonna have to do to prove their innocence.
All right. DJ M already brought it up. Let's just fucking open the gate.
All right. Anthony Peterson, Knicks fan. They still exist. Trained a half court shot at Madison Square Garden during a game. I've seen this happen a couple times at Kings games. You know, like that somebody comes out and shoot the half court shot for a contest for the Kings. Sometimes. One of the local Toyota dealerships will give them like a truck or sometimes $25,000 or something on that level. You know, half court shots are hard, but you know, it's a prize kind of fitting for hitting something very unlikely. Anthony Peterson's prize was $1,000 in scratchers. So not actually $1,000, but like probably significantly less or maybe a little bit more, depending on he 200 tickets is what it was. So the guy had to go through and scratch out 200 tickets. Eventually, after he scratched everything off, it turned out he won $500 total.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in Los Angeles won $100,000 for hitting the same shot at a Lakers game. So without having to scratch off 200 tickets.
Yeah. That's just the garbage that the Knicks are at this point.
This is the Mecca, Kaz. This organization.
At this point, the world's most famous arena.
And
they're just.
Yes, the world's most famous arena, the most valuable franchise in the NBA, worth around $4 billion if you are to believe Forbes' valuations. It's basketball Mecca where you can hit half court shots and win $1,000 in scratchers that you then have to scratch off and find that you only won $500. I think the 50-50 raffle that they do at NBA games we'll give you more.
Yeah.
And all you got to do is buy tickets for that. Like, it's, and half that money goes to charity. So, and that charity doesn't have to scratch off a bunch of scratchers to claim that money. So, way to go, Knicks.
Good job on you. Good on you. Great. Right. Glad we're here. Glad this is what we're doing with our fucking time.
All right. Football. We're down to the final four teams.
Yeah. So this is amazing, right? So we're down to the 49ers and Packers. Two teams battled very, very hard this season to get where they are. And then we are also down to the Chiefs. Amazing, great fucking team. And the Titans.
So the Titans surprised everybody. By beating the Baltimore Ravens and our boy Lamar Jackson. I think I got a little sick of the hot takes that came out after the game. Lamar Jackson made a couple mistakes in the game, maybe more than a couple. But overall, I think he still had a pretty productive game. Threw for over 300 yards, ran for over 100 yards. He kind of did his normal thing, but also threw a couple interceptions. Okay. And I feel like the rest... I feel like that was a team loss. That's mm-hmm. that's what I'm saying.
Well, it definitely was a team loss, but I think watching the highlights of things leading up to the game and kind of the talking points from the talking heads and saying how kind of really well put together and how well the Titans defense works really well together. And the fact that they think they lost a lot more games due to their offense than to their defense. And those are all kind of things that those talking head things kind of come in hindsight. But after watching that game, I really do think that the Titans defense is really good. They have really good reads, and I think they're just better at adapting to this style of quarterback that we tend to praise here, which is the Lamar Jacksons, the Patrick Mahomes kind of style. So I think as much as I like the Chiefs in this matchup and kind of just in this position that they're in, I think they're going to have a hard time with the Titans.
Yeah, Mike Vrabel's got them playing incredibly well. Mike Vrabel, a Bill Belichick disciple. The Titans, do I have this right? They beat the Patriots, right? The week mm-hmm. before. So, like, at that point, like, something's up. Like, mm-hmm. the disciple outcoached his mentor. And then, yeah, so like at this point, they should not be sneaking up on anybody, but they still managed to sneak up on us. And this was a team that started off the season not doing very well. Like Marcus Mariota was the starter and Ryan Tannehill was the backup. But, you know, Ryan Tannehill, who some people might say didn't really get the fairest shot in Miami, is now playing incredibly well. And, you know, just a big long string of wins and now the Titans are in the playoffs and they are hot at the right time and incredibly confident in themselves. So that's a dangerous team. The Chiefs are a dangerous team just on their own, but I'm excited for what this matchup brings. And so we can laugh at the Titans a little bit, but I feel like at this point, they've shown that they are not a team to laugh at and they're dangerous. And I think they've got just as much of a shot to win this game as the Chiefs do. But if the Chiefs get hot, like we've seen that they can run off 50 unanswered points.
Yeah.
So
they score a lot of goddamn points. I know a lot of people, and I've agreed to a certain extent, I've given a lot of praise to Lamar Jackson, but I really, really, really still think that Patrick Mahomes is kind of the just, I don't know. I really like the kid. I think he's really good at what he does.
Last year, we took to calling him the chosen one, Patrick Mahomes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think that should stop. I just think Lamar had a really good run, but in this position we're in, right, Patrick Mahomes has only really consistently gotten better. It's I don't know. I think it's an era where I think these two guys are just really good at what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's weird to think of Ryan Tannehill as kind of the old guard, but yeah, that's kind of the role he's playing. Just this old guard quarterback with a second chance, trying to hold off the high powered Chiefs and the chosen one.
Guys, hot take time. Cass, you first. Do you believe Ryan Tannehill was always good? Yes or no?
No.
JVZ, same question. Was Ryan Tannehill always good and just stuck in Miami?
I'm going to take good in like the most literal, plain way. Like he's always been good. I don't think he's been occasionally great. And I don't think he's ever been amazing, but he's always been good. And okay. and sometimes the team hasn't been good enough to make him look as good as he normally is.
I agree with JVZ. Ryan Tannehill is the Matt Stafford of the AFC.
Okay. So at the very least, this matchup is nice because it doesn't include the Patriots. So we're finally going to get a new representative in the AFC after several years of Patriot dominance. There's questions now of whether this is the end for Tom Brady, or at least the end of his time with the Patriots.
We'll always have that questions, but he'll always be touchdown Tom until he's not. And I don't think he's not yet.
Yeah, I think the favorite is now.
He hasn't sold enough fucking copies of TB12 to retire yet.
Yeah. There's talk that he might head to the Chargers. You can find out what we think about that in our prediction show. For the matchup in the NFC, we've got the 49ers and the Packers, which sounds like it's a we're back in the 90s, which is okay with me, because that's when both teams were pretty good. And, these two teams matched up on Sunday night earlier in the year, and the Niners kind of trounced them. So just on that alone, I'm feeling pretty good about the 49ers, especially since they're getting healthier on defense. They do tend to struggle with mobile quarterbacks. I'm grateful that they don't have to play Russell Wilson for a third time this year, because both games went incredibly close. Both games were decided by the very last play. This game is going to be in Santa Clara, so the 49ers will have home field advantage. It's been kind of a notoriously quiet stadium in the past, but I think people are happy to have something to root for in the Bay Area now, with the Raiders leaving, the Warriors sucking, and nobody just going to A's games in general, and the Giants not playing very well. I think people are getting behind the 49ers, and I think the 49ers are a talented team, and they were a talented team last year that got bit by injuries and lucked into the second pick of the draft, where they shored up their defense even more by drafting Nick Bosa. So they've got a really tough pass rush, and all the guys that they had injured on their defensive line are back and at least somewhat healthy enough to play. So they're going to give the Packers offensive line fits. So I was concerned about the 49ers going up against, like I mentioned, going up against the Seahawks again, and that didn't happen. I was concerned about them having to play the Ravens, in the Super Bowl if they were to make it that far. And looks like that's not going to happen. So it kind of feels like the road to what could be their sixth Super Bowl title is kind of clearing up. But I don't want to get too far ahead of myself because the Packers are still a good team. They were the second seed in the NFC for a reason. Aaron Rodgers is still Aaron Rodgers, and he can still make magic on any given night. So, I think we've got four very good teams in the semifinals or in the conference championship games. And so we'll have to see how this plays out. And I'm crossing my fingers for the 49ers. And DJM wants to give a shout out to the 49ers for finding a guy from TV, from like an announcer on TV, and making him the general manager of the team and having it actually work out. Because that didn't quite work out for the Lions when they got Matt Millen. Although they gave him a lot of time to try to figure it out.
Speaking of finding and firing, we're going to talk about a couple of the hires and fires for the NFL head coaches that have come pretty, early. I don't know.
I think this is like, it's weird. I'm glad that you said that because it's weird that all these hirings and stuff take place before the end of the season, because a lot of the guys that they're trying to interview and hire are like they're assistants for playoff teams. And so like they're supposed to be preparing for playoff games and then they got to take time out to go interview with all these shit teams that, that are looking for a new coach. And so yeah, it's weird. Like, I feel like the NFL needs to do something about like pushing the period back until after the season is over then you can start interviewing people. But everybody wants to get a head start so that they can start building before the draft and before free agency and all that. So sorry, go ahead. I just wanted to interject because I'm glad that you
brought up how weird some of this timing is for this. Yeah. All right, let's just start at the top of the list. So the Carolina Panthers, who went 5-11, fired their coach and have hired Matt Rhule to become their new head coach. I'm not familiar with Matt Rhule. I don't know.
Nope, not either. That's
what lineage he comes Baylor from.
Head coach. That's all I know.
Chip Baylor. Okay. So I guess that's a one we're not familiar with. We're going to see how that pans out. That's kind of an upgrade coming from the college era to here.
Yeah, which has had mixed results. I think Pete Carroll is probably the best example of a guy who he had NFL experience before then. Sometimes guys from college that try to bring their same college system into the NFL, like they don't do so well just because NFL players are better and faster and their defenses are tougher and it can be a mixed bag.
So going down the list from the Panthers, we go to the Cleveland Browns, which is a team that we talked about a lot. I liked their kind of the makeup of their team kind of early on in the season, but it didn't really pan out that well, even though I think they also, much like the Giants, had a really, really, really amazing receiving core and a good running back, but just didn't really seem to work out that well for them. They ended up going 6-10 this season. They ended up, or they're in talks to hire offensive coordinator for the Vikings, Kevin Stefanski.
Stefanski. I think kind of a weird hire because, there was a little bit of criticism of the Vikings offense earlier in the season, specifically centered around Kirk Cousins. So, they managed to get it together and, The Cleveland also interviewed the Robert Saleh, the defensive coordinator for the 49ers. So I'm kind of glad they didn't hire him. We'll see. I mean, the Browns are probably going to run it back with the same roster next year. So we'll see if a different coach can get
definitely a results based thing, because their previous coach, Freddie Kitchens, was hired last year. So he was given one season, went 6-10 and was shown the door. So this is definitely a team looking for results.
This job is a revolving door in general. I'm surprised that they let Hugh Jackson stay for as long as they did, Kitchens replaced. Well, I guess they kind of had like an interim situation going on after they fired Jackson midseason, and now they've got they tried Kitchens, and I think by midseason it was pretty clear that he wasn't going to last, and then try again next year. And they had a lot of expectations coming into this season and fell way short of them. So we'll see what happens.
So Jerry Jones and the boys, as I like to call them, went 8-8 this season. And because he still feels like he can't hire himself as the head coach, he decided to hire Mike McCarthy, after a only 48 hours, which in previous years he's taken like weeks, to go through the process of interviewing and hiring coaches. So there must be something special about Mike McCarthy that Jerry Jones decided very quickly that this was his guy. But also, this ESPN article says he only interviewed two people. One of them was Mike McCarthy. The other one was Marvin Lewis.
So, I mean, Mike McCarthy won a Super Bowl with the Packers. I think he kind of, I mean, once you win a Super Bowl, you get a couple years after that, just, you know, as like, hey, this guy's a Super Bowl winning coach. Like, we can't get rid of him now. I think he basically had a pretty good tenure, but I think at some point the Packers decided it was time to move on. And I think it proved to be a pretty good decision, considering they're still in the hunt for a Super Bowl this year. But McCarthy is you know, a pretty decent offensive mind, and he helped turn Aaron Rodgers into the player that he is today. So I guess they're hoping that he can do that with Dak Prescott, who has been productive, but I think people are looking for more and just more from the whole team in general. We'll see what happens with Mike McCarthy. Joe Judge is the new head coach for the New York Giants. How do you feel about this?
I don't care right now. I don't know. Okay. It's just so bad. But he is a Belichick prodigy. And I guess that generally tends to boast well for a guy if you come from the Belichick school. So we'll see what he can do.
No, it doesn't. It's been just the opposite for coaches from the Belichick tree, save for Bill O'Brien, who has been criticized heavily during his time as Houston Texans coach.
And Mike Vrabel.
Mike Vrabel now.
These guys keep That's getting fair. Interviews, and they keep getting jobs, and every fucking thing you watch, you're like, oh, he's a fucking Belichick prodigy, so you know what that means.
And they're bad, just like Matt Patricia. Yes, I'm going there. I was trying to be subtle about it, but I will beat you over the head with it. I meant Matt Patricia too. Yeah, in most cases, coaches from the Belichick tree that were his coordinators or assistant coaches, they've not done well.
Yeah, and in a way, it's like how badly they've failed has just further built up the legend of Bill Belichick and how good he must be. because none of these guys survive without him. So we'll have to wait and see. And Ron Rivera, who was the coach fired from the Carolina Panthers, is now in Washington. So, and he's brought most of his staff with him. So it's,
yeah, that was a scorched earth kind of looking. They showed anyone who they thought could see the door, they showed them the door.
All right. So I guess that's it for the roundup. I think we spent a lot longer on that than we wanted to, but, now we're headed into the big story of the day. The last couple of weeks it's been simmering, but everything really blew up today. And we're talking about the sign stealing scandal from the Houston Astros. The MLB released their report earlier this week about who, they figured out who was to blame and all that. They interviewed a bunch of players. And so what they suspended, Astros general manager Jeff Lunau and manager AJ Hinch for a year, and once that suspension came down, the Astros just straight up fired them. The suspension still holds. Like, if somebody were to hire these guys, they couldn't participate in any baseball activities for at least until the end of the World Series this year. It's just kind of cleaning house in Houston to try to wash the organization's hands of these guys, even though some of the players are still around. Some of the people who are no longer with the organization also got caught in the fallout. So Alex Cora, the manager of the Boston Red Sox, who was Houston's bench coach at the time that this alleged sign stealing took place, he was fired. Although I guess the official stance is that they agreed to a mutual termination, but ultimately this is, we don't want you around. We don't want the stink of you and the scandal around anymore. So you can go, and we'll call it mutual just to make it clean. And not just him, but, Carlos Beltran, who is, I guess the newly hired manager of the Mets, was an Astros player at the time the scandal took place, and he was fired as well. So that is, from one scandal, three different managers all taken out, one general manager, no players suspended, but now there's like suspicion surrounding everybody involved. They're not going to like overturn any championships or anything like that, but there's always going to be a stink on the Astros title that they won. There's always going to be some second guessing on, regarding some of the players whose legacies were changed because they were beaten by the Astros. Like, Clayton Kershaw is a guy that we've brought up a couple times, as a guy who's kind of cursed. And so, like, how would that narrative be different had the Astros not been stealing his signs? And some of these are heavy punishments levied towards individuals, but I'm also reading a lot of talk that considering the overall impact to the game, to players, to because this took place over the course of a year, over 162 games plus playoffs, mm-hmm. and like how many players, how many individuals were affected by this, how many individuals were victimized by this, and not even just
big organizations like that, along with managers and former players losing their jobs. Major League Baseball also fined the Astros organization $5 million and took away their first and second round draft picks for 2020 and 2021.
Yeah, and that $5 million, if it sounds low, I think that's the maximum allowed. So that's why it's $5 million. So But I mean, that's nothing compared to the revenue bump that a team sees from winning a World Series. So in a way, it was kind of worth it. And yeah, I mean, even if they were to vacate that championship, like, they still had a parade. They still, you know, their fans still got to experience the joy of watching their team win a title, while a team like the Dodgers, you know, they have had to deal with heartbreak after heartbreak every year. You can't undo this. You can't clean this situation up. But ultimately, what I'm most surprised about in this whole thing is that, like, this thing was organized by players. And I think it was even reported that manager AJ Hinch actually tried to damage the equipment that was used in the scandal, so that, that was being used in the sign stealing process to try to get his players to stop. And, but he couldn't stop them. But yet no players were punished or suspended for this. I mean, you could argue that Carlos Beltran got fired, and he was a player at the time, but overall, like, I think the baseball has kind of taken the stance that if the players interviewed, and because they were forthcoming about this, then they get leniency on this. And also, on top of that, the MLB Players Union is pretty powerful. But even though they don't get any concrete penalties, I think they'll have the penalty of having the stink of the scandal on all of these individual players, for the rest of their careers. Just the same way that, you know, a player caught using steroids would have that stink on them as well. So it's massive. And a lot of this kind of came out today, at least as far as the collateral damage manager firings. Those all happened today. And on top of that, a couple, you know, Jessica Mendoza, the broadcaster, got caught up in this too, because for some reason she is allowed to be a broadcaster while also being an advisor to the Mets, which is kind of this weird conflict of interest. But, you know, the Mets being caught up in the scandal, and Mendoza called out Mike Fiers, the whistleblower, and said that, like, he kind of should have kept this thing in house and shouldn't have gone public to The Athletic, who broke this story. And it's weird for a media member to be saying stuff like that. It's a media member
that was a former player.
Yeah, a media member that was a former player, but also she is an advisor to a team that got caught up in the scandal. And so it's, you know, it definitely calls into question, you know, her biases. The scandal has exploded at this point, and I think it's still expanding. There's talk about, you know, I mean, there's rumors now about the Astros using buzzers to communicate this year, instead of using, like, the banging on the trash can that they were doing before. All the Twitter investigators are coming out, and they're examining people's clothing at this point to see if they can find, like, wires and buzzers and stuff underneath the uniforms. Like, that's how crazy this has gotten, and it is just getting
bigger. Just trying to win games, guys. Just trying to win games.
Yeah.
Just trying to compete. Just trying to compete. Just trying to win games.
Could be up to 8 teams or so that might eventually get caught up in this, but those are kind of rumors at this point and not fully corroborated. So this web keeps getting more and more intricate and keeps catching more and more people involved. I didn't expect you don't get caught. Yeah. I didn't even consider that this could be a thing before this story broke, and now it's so much of a thing that, that 10% of the league has had to fire their managers, and so it's it's a hell of a scandal, and it's, you know, on our list of wait and see stories, this is at the top of the list now.
Let's move on to something a little bit more optimistic than the possible death of the MLB.
Okay, I didn't go that far, but yeah.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. let's talk about the WNBA.
Yeah, I'm really happy about this one because the players signed a new collective bargaining agreement, and or at least they've agreed in principle to mm-hmm. To a lot of increases in benefits, benefits, salary, like everything across the board. A lot of things that we've complained about over the last year, the last couple of years, like travel, all of that is included in this. This agreement is going to last for 8 years with the opt-outs after 6 years. A 53% increase in like total cash compensation, which includes salary and bonuses and prize pools and stuff. The max salary is increasing to $215,000 from $117,000. I still think that's kind of low. And I think any situation where the max salary of the WNBA player is less than the minimum salary of an NBA player is too low, but it's headed in the right direction, at least. At least it's the point where there are players like Sue Bird coming out and saying that if they made this much coming out of college, then they wouldn't be playing overseas in the off season, which is a big deal because, you know, especially this past season, because, you know, the MVP of the WNBA, Breonna Stewart, got injured playing overseas in the off season because she wasn't getting paid enough to have just one job here in the United States. So, yeah. So, I mean, this increase is enough to push over that threshold where a lot of players will consider not playing overseas in the off season. So they can actually get a break every year. Their bodies have a chance to recover. Yeah, and they can have longer, more fruitful careers here in the WNBA rather than trying to collect money overseas. I want to put these numbers into perspective because anytime something like this comes out, you get weirdos coming out of the woodwork complaining about how the WNBA hasn't actually turned a profit. The salary cap for a WNBA team, this is the amount of money that they are allowed to pay all of the players on the team in total, is $1.3 million. It's weird to see people complain about an amount that low. The entire collective salary of the 12 WNBA teams is less than the amount of money that Andre Iguodala is being paid to sit on the bench for the Memphis Grizzlies this year. So,
of all people, why are you going to come at Iguodala?
Because I looked at the numbers. I found like what is like $16 million. And I found the guy who is... DJM is asking the question, does he even go to the games? And like, is he even on the bench? And like, it's... That is waste. Investing in the future of women's basketball is not waste. If you were to take this money, the entire cost of the WNBA, and instead of just calling it the WNBA in like the accounting sheets, you just change the line item to say advertising, change it to say marketing for women you could call it diversity, but if you just said like, you know, the league right now doesn't market towards women that well. So we are increasing the budget to market towards women. And we're going to do that by creating a league for women, but like, let's not call it that. I don't think people would complain that much. It's like, oh yeah, sure. They want to make more money marketing towards women, and $20 million to do that. Not a big deal. But you frame it as we're going to make a league for women. And then you get all these guys talking about profits, and like, it's not, it's at this point, it's a lost leader, and I don't think they've invested enough at this point to even evaluate it when it comes to like whether this league is profitable or not, because they haven't invested enough to let this thing stand on its own. It's, you know, like, and that's not just when it comes to player salaries, but it's with bullshit, like, you know, having games canceled because players have to fly normal commercial flights and they can't get to games on time sometimes because there's delays, you know, or, you know, the players have to play overseas and they get injured and, you know, and it's, you know, it hampers the league's ability to grow when you don't give the players enough that they can focus entirely on growing. So yeah. I think this particular deal at least brings them closer to that. We could argue all we want about equity in comparison with what the men make, but at least this gets you to the point where this is a viable career. And once you get it to that point, then the talent pool coming in out of college starts looking at this as a viable career. You know, players in high school, they start targeting this as something that they want to do for the rest of their you know, as a career. So it's, I don't think the WNBA is, you know, it's not there yet when it comes to, you know, can this sustain itself on its own, but it's going to get closer and it's going to grow closer rapidly with this new change. And so regarding the travel stuff, they are getting better travel. They're at least they're not getting chartered flights, but they're getting, you know, they get to fly premium economy now. So they get a little bit better scheduling for that. And each player actually gets to have their own hotel room now, which they didn't before. They had to share. So on top of that, maternity leave, childcare, you know, family planning benefits, which I think is important for a league full of women in their 20s and 30s, because it's the sort of situation where they kind of have to put off their family life, you know, and delay it until later in life, until their career is over. Otherwise, otherwise a pregnancy could, you know, put them on the sideline for a year. So, yeah. So I mean, those are very specific benefits that are very important to a women's league. So I'm glad that was included in this. Everybody seems to be pretty happy at this.
Something else in here that is snaking its way from the NBA is the mid-season tournament.
Yeah, I think it's really nice that they're trying to kind of shake things up a little bit, and use it as a testing ground for changes that they might want to make in the NBA. So this year, because the WNBA plays in the summer, like every 4 years, they get interrupted by the Summer Olympics. So the best American players then have to, you know, go play for the Olympic team. But when they come back, I think that's going to be when this midseason tournament starts this year. And so it'll be a nice testing ground for the NBA midseason tournament. They'll get a chance to see what works and what doesn't. And although the WNBA does play fewer games, it does kind of answer the question of like what happens when you take a more games and stick them in the middle of the season, into an already tight schedule, especially this year with the Olympics interrupting the schedule. So
I think scheduling and placement of these tournaments is going to be the biggest thing. I think very much like all-star events, it should maybe just happen in one or two places at most. And then you could probably do this in different locations every year just to help, you know, maybe fodder some money to different regions and tournaments. I mean, in places and stuff like that. So like, you know, it could be in Milwaukee 1 year, you know, where it's like a week long thing. So you have people flying out to come check out the tournament, and I mean on both sides, NBA and WNBA. So I have ideas for this as we've been talking about it, but this is not the place to talk about that. But yes, I think this is definitely a good. I don't want to call this a first step. I think this is a bigger step than a first step into definitely making the WNBA more friendly for the players and possibly for the viewers. We'll see how that works out as well. So last story, best story sometimes, but we'll see how this one works out. There are some new rules coming from the XFL. We have been kind of talking about the ever coming XFL as it is encroaching more and more on that time for them to rejoin the realm. But we got some new rule changes from them. You want to go over these and or cherry pick some of your favorites?
Yeah, for the complete list, head on over to xfl.com/rules. I like that they made that easy. This article is actually really extensive because they've explained every rule change and included like another. They've got videos showing how it's supposed to work, and then they put it in context with the existing college and NFL rules and the rationale for why they chose to make this rule change. So a lot of these are focused on safety. XFL commissioner Oliver Luck, who is actually the father of Andrew Luck. He's gone on interviews saying that they surveyed a bunch of people asking them like what their complaints are about the NFL. They actually then like suggested a bunch of changes, and then like over a weekend or so, like they all met up in some place, and they actually like had players, you know, come out and test these rule changes to see how they work. So it's not like they're just throwing stuff at the wall. Like some of the stuff did stick and some of it didn't. Just kind of remember all that as we discuss these rules. But the first one here, which I think is a pretty fundamental game changer. You're allowed 2 forward passes on a play now. As long as both passes come from behind the line of scrimmage. So it used to be before that, if you wanted to throw a pass from the side, like you had to lateral the ball to the side, which was the first one was a backward pass, and any lateral is a potential fumble if it's not collected cleanly. So so they were inherently very risky, but now. Having 2 forward passes basically really opens up the playbook when it comes to strategy. Like you could legitimately run a 2 quarterback system if you are allowed 2 forward passes in a play. So that just that on its own just kind of blows my mind a little bit. I don't even know where that rule might take us, but just the intrigue behind that, that's something that I might want to tune in to watch. Point after touchdowns. The NFL recently had to move the point after kick back from like a 20-yard field goal that was made 99.7% of the time to a 30-yard field goal, or a 35-yard field goal, which is made 95% of the time. So it's kind of like these players are more ceremonial than anything else. Like people just assume that when you score a touchdown, that's 7 points instead of 6 plus 1, maybe. So the XFL is looking to change that up. You can now get 1 point, 2 points, or 3 points after a touchdown. And these are not kicking plays. You just run a play from either the 2-yard line, the 5-yard line, or the 10-yard line. And if you are successful on that play, you get that number of points. And if the defense intercepts the ball and runs it back, or there's a fumble and they run it back, the defense gets those points, the same number of points that you were going for. So it kind of makes the play more like what you would, less kicking involved and more normal football play, which is weird when you think about the way those words come out, but still. More of the things people enjoy about football and less of the meaningless kicking stuff. Moving to kickoffs and punts, these are some of the most dangerous plays in the NFL currently. And so now they've changed the rules to where that people that are supposed to be blocking, they have to line up pretty close to each other, and they're not allowed to move until the ball is caught by the kickoff returner or the punt returner. And so that eliminates having like lines of people lining up 30 yards away from each other and just charging into each other full speed,
yeah.
Which is where a lot of the injuries occur. I think it's like 20, I might be wrong about this, but it's like 25% of all concussions occur during kickoffs. So it's like the NFL has changed this by trying to discourage kickoffs and trying to like encourage touchbacks, which in a way is weird when you structure the rules so that plays that you have to just play just because they're in the rules have less, so that you don't have to play the plays that you have to play because the rules say you have to play them. I muddled that, but it's like, why have kickoffs if you're going to make kickoffs meaningless? So they're changing these rules up a little bit. And the fact that nobody's allowed to move until the kick returner goes means that the kick returner has a lot of room to run, which makes the kickoff pretty significant when it actually does happen. Touchbacks are 35 yards. So if you punt and that ball goes into the end zone, that's the team gets the ball on the 35-yard line, which means if you are past the 50-yard line, you might as well not punt. So this is a rule designed to discourage punts in general, which people don't like. So so that's going to help with the watchability of the game. More teams are going to go for it on fourth down, which statistics show in the NFL you should do that anyways, but coaches are very risk averse. Now the rules make it so that it's obvious that you should go for it on fourth down most of the time. So that's going to make the game a little bit more entertaining, more scoring, less punting. The overtime rules are pretty complicated in the NFL. And so in an effort to simplify it, they make it kind of like a penalty shootout in soccer. Just each team runs five plays from the 5-yard line, and whoever is successful in scoring a touchdown on those plays the most is the winner of the game. And if they have to go to sudden death, they go to sudden death, but it'll just work the same way as a penalty shootout, which is, I'm kind of surprised nobody thought of this before, because it is kind of nice in how simple it is. Other than that, a couple pace changes, 25-second play clock. They're encouraging comebacks by in the last 2 minutes of the game, the clock will stop after pretty much every play that's inbounds for 5 seconds while they spot the ball. And they'll have a dedicated official to do that so that there's less dead time. The rest of the game is just under a running clock. Live replay officials to make replays go faster, 10 minutes halftime. They want to get these games back under 3 hours. So it's less of a pain to have to sit through an entire game, which has been a problem for football in the past. So
there's a lot of this stuff that I like. But the one thing that is a little weird to me is the PAT, the point after touchdown. So the NFL standard and pretty much the college standard, which is what the two things they keep comparing themselves to in these rule changes is after a touchdown, you get a kick. I forget from where. I think it's the
35
for 1 point, or you can go for a 2 point conversion. Here, it is only a play run that you can run after a touchdown for 1, 2, or 3 points, yep. Depending on the spot of the ball, the five, I think it's the one, the
two,
five,
two, five, and ten.
Two, five, and ten. Because they're like, oh man, you know, the kicking option is just an automatic 1 point. Like, I understand how they're trying to make it sound, but I don't know. It's weird.
It wasn't that automatic, but it was nearly automatic, and to the point where it was almost an afterthought.
I mean, I think the kick should be from the 40, because I think most guys can do that anyway. But I think that gives enough air time for the ball to you know, make changes. But in general, I don't know. One's a weird one to me.
The thing is, that's not an uncommon suggestion, but it's almost like at some point, kickers got really, really good at kicking.
Yeah.
And they got it down to a science to the point where the original extra point, it used to be not as automatic, but then it became automatic because people got so good at it. And then they moved it back to the 35, not the 35 yard line, but a 35 yard field goal. And then it dipped a little bit. And then now it's come back up because people got good at it. And so like you can keep moving it back further and further. And eventually it'll get to the point where these guys are just regularly hitting 50 yard field goals for a point after. And
I also think because then there is also the thing where they say like, oh, so for the defense, if they get the ball in one of these versions of these plays from the 2, the 5, or the 10, they get the amount of points that the offense was going for. Well,
they have to run it back for a touchdown.
Right, if they run it back, where I'm pretty sure if you block a punt and you take it, you get 6, right, in the NFL?
On a normal punt play, if you block block a point after field goal, then you get 2 points now.
Okay.
Which was a recent change, but it effectively it's like a 2 point conversion. So now it's just you get whatever the offense was going for. The 3 point option is kind of it's an interesting wrinkle to this because that definitely did not exist before. But that means when you score a touchdown, you have the potential to get 9 points. Out of that play. The point that they're making is like if you're down by 18 points, that's a two possession game, so nobody's out of it. Comebacks can happen. Don't change the channel. Like, you know, this is like this game is still not out of reach. So I think that's that's a good rule change for.
I mean. In general, for a timing standpoint, I think there is good things here. For a viewership standpoint, I think there are a lot of good things here. I think also from a viewership standpoint, there are just going to be things that people are going to think are weird. This point after touchdown thing, I think most football fans are going to find weird. It's going to take some adjusting. I don't think it's viewer prohibitive, but I definitely think it's going to be something that people will have to adjust to. The 25 second play clock, I think is a good thing too. Just kind of move the game along. I don't know. Those are kind of the standouts to me, other than the things that you kind of actually ran down and gave a lot of detail to.
Let me ask you this, because we know the XFL players, they're going to be subpar players. They're going to be guys that can't make it in the NFL or like fringe players.
Mm-hmm.
So guys that you wouldn't normally want to pay.
Johnny Manziel.
maybe. but yeah, like guys of that caliber. So knowing that this is a subpar league, you wouldn't necessarily want to tune into this normally, or maybe you would. I mean, the Alliance of American Football was kind of moderately successful, even though it wasn't financially successful. But from a viewership standpoint, I feel like there was buzz around the league. So it'd be those same caliber of players in this league. Does all of these rule changes now make it a lot more interesting, make it in a way you want to tune in because you want to see how these rule changes play out?
And I think initially, yeah, but I think at some point you have to have a good product.
Yeah. While I agree, I think if the game distinguishes itself enough from the NFL, then maybe they can carve out a niche like the Arena Football League did at some point. Maybe that's a bad example because the league just folded recently. But it managed to last for a pretty long time. And you know, the Alliance of American Football set the bar pretty low when it folded in the middle of its first season. So the XFL hopefully will last like a season or more and kind of become this nice little training ground, not just for these players, but as like experimentation in the game and trying to change the way football is played, both from a strategic standpoint, from a viewership and watchability standpoint, but also from a safety standpoint. It's nice to kind of have this competition, and it's nice to see that they're trying to do something different than the NFL than just saying, we're just NFL light. So I'm pretty excited about this. February 8th is when the league starts, so I'm going to be tuning in. We'll see how this works.
We'll let you know what we think. I think we're both going to end up checking this out just to kind of see what it is and how it plays out.
All right. Thank you all for checking out our show. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com for links to all of these stories, especially this XFL one. Thank you for subscribing on iTunes and other podcast networks. You can find links to those on the website as well. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you want to contribute financially. We're going to start recording some special banked episodes. So if you are a patron, you will get those basically as soon as they are edited. But otherwise, we will release those during the weeks that we take off. If you're interested in that, check that out. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.